Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thank you one and all for spending some time with us. As I always say, if you weren't there, I would just be sitting here talking to myself. So I'm really glad that you tune in and enjoy this with us. My guest tonight is Mel Schwartz, whose book is The Possibility Principle, and he's going to be talking about how quantum physics can improve your daily life, which I think is fascinating. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing, which is sort of on the same topic, I guess. We all have those people in our lives that we've known for a long time, but never really got along with. And the good news about the story I'm going to tell you is this is a peripheral relative of a high school friend, his kid's sister. And she doesn't like anything that she can't put in a box and call scientific. So she posted something which my friend posted, which is how I saw it. And its bottom line was that all of that stuff is superstition. It's just based on faith. There's nothing to it. You can't prove it. Needless to say, I had a few things to say about that. And the conversation with her didn't go very well, but it brought up some interesting thoughts about that whole back and forth about what is proof and what is science and what's going on out there. Science is a really fascinating thing. First of all, there could be things going on in science that are fairly well established, and you wouldn't know about that little corner of scientific inquiry unless you were in that field reading those magazines, going to those lectures, talking to those people, because there are small groups of people doing very complex, narrow studies of all kinds of stuff. And it doesn't become mainstream science and well-known until it gets to the big conferences and gets in textbooks and that kind of stuff. So first of all, most people don't have any idea what's going on in scientific study. But even without that, the whole idea of proof gets really interesting when you get into metaphysics or shamanic work or any of those kinds of things, because all of that is about results. It really is a scientific inquiry. You do something which could be couched as an experiment. I'm going to do this and see what happens. And there's a result. And in that work, if you don't get results, nobody comes to you. It just, there has to be an outcome that is beneficial to people. That's the whole point to that work. A shaman is somebody who helps his community. That's his job. Help people be healthier, help with all kinds of things. You don't have to get into the whole cultural thing of how shamans function in different societies. And shamanism is such a broad thing. And metaphysics also. Metaphysics is what the precursor of science. Astrology was what came before astronomy. Or maybe it's the same thing, just astronomy doesn't have the backstory. Alchemy was the precursor of chemistry. All of those things were done in the same way. Let's try this and see what happens. Oh, that worked. Now we've got proof. What are we going to do next? So I have a really hard time when someone says, you don't have scientific proof. The other thing is when, you're just this energy stuff. What's this crazy energy stuff you're talking about? If you look at what science has told us they know, in quotation marks, big air quotes, there is about 5% maybe of the universe that is made up of physical stuff. Planets, stars, our physical bodies, all the animals and plants on our planet, all the stuff that is physical, that has mass. And everything else they call dark matter and dark energy. They call it dark because there is no technology yet to measure it. They don't know exactly what it is. They know dark matter has mass because it affects gravity. Its gravity is doing all kinds of things to the universe, and they can measure that, but they don't really know exactly how. They don't have information yet. And so when somebody says, well, you're talking about stuff, what are you talking about? Talking about that other 95% of everything in the universe that science doesn't have an answer for. So it's an interesting conversation. It was unfortunately an emotional conversation because of the way it went down and the people involved. But even as I was talking to our guest just before this, and he pointed out that even Einstein didn't believe in spooky action at a distance, that things could be affected far away, which quantum physics was showing, or that probability was a reasonable way to look at the universe. He had all kinds of things that he didn't like about that. He had discovered some things which changed our entire understanding of the universe, but quantum mechanics was a different change, and he never quite resolved his discomfort with some of the things that are there. And the truth is, we still don't have a theory of everything. We still can't reconcile the theory of relativity that Einstein did with quantum mechanics. Everybody wants to do that, but it hasn't quite happened yet. So the next time there's one of those conversations about this stuff is woo-woo and superstitious, you know, you can have the argument or not, but it's not woo-woo or superstitious. It works. So what are you going to do with the results? Anyway, that's my rant for tonight. Tonight's metaphysical musing. And let's meet our guest, Mel Schwartz. Hey, Mel.
Hello, David. Happy to join you.
Glad to have you here. And you're physically not that far away, which is always fun.
I couldn't help but retrieve an old thought when you were talking about the theory of everything, which, mm-hmm. you know, for any of your listeners who aren't fully aware, it's that the reality of the larger universe, our universe and reality and larger, acts differently than the quantum universe. And so Scientists have been looking, how do we unite this? What's the one theory that combines all? And I thought about that. And I'm not a scientist, but my intuition is, you know what reconciles the two different realities? What intervenes between the quantum reality and the larger macro reality? It's us. It's our consciousness. And maybe the reason that macro reality performs differently than quantum is our consciousness is more present in this reality. So through that perception, we see two different operating rules of reality. Just a thought.
I like it. Well, there also is a larger conversation that the universe is conscious and we're actually a part of that consciousness, and that all events, including matter, are a part of this much larger consciousness, which most people are not willing to accept could even exist.
So if we take that concept and make it more personal, I make the point in my book that human consciousness is the primary driver of reality, of the reality-making mm-hmm. process, and of the material universe. Our consciousness is the fundamental driving force of reality. And when we speak of the universe, it's also important in our minds to include us in the picture. The universe is not separate and out there.
Right.
We create the universe.
Right. There are all kinds of fascinating questions with that, since each person's perceptions are different. Even our sensory perceptions are different. How are we experiencing the same physical reality? I keep struggling with that one. I don't know at this point, what the answer is.
arguably, we're not. So So let's look at some of my work, and a couple of my chapters in my book are about relationships and communication.
Well, let's just position the work that you've been doing and the premise of the book.
Certainly. The premise of my book is I'm a psychotherapist, a marriage counselor, and my newest book, The Possibility Principle, How Quantum Physics Can Improve Our Life, is I take some primary principles of quantum physics. Simply, the quantum reality is steeped in uncertainty. Not certainty, but uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily in our lives, we're taught to avoid uncertainty. I gave a TEDx talk 2 weeks ago that anxiety comes from our thoughts being addicted to certainty. We were taught this by Newton, his theory of determinism.
Right.
We have enough information, we can predict the future. So anxiety and fear, the epidemic of anxiety, is due to our needing to know the future, which is unknowable. So I flip that on its side and say, well, quantum reality is about uncertainty, and that appears as prevalent in our reality as the quantum. Now, I take that as good news. If we learn to embrace uncertainty, we're riding the waves of change in our life. We're not stuck in fear. We're not sitting back strategizing and calculating life. We're participating in the creating of our life. Embracing uncertainty equals new possibility, hence my title, The Possibility Principle. Open to uncertainty, you bring possibility into your life. Your life is in a state of pure potential. Secondly, the quantum reality is, just as the mystics and Eastern religions have always taught us, is essentially one inseparable whole. It's inseparable. It's not interconnected. Because interconnected implies there's a separation and you found a connection. No, no connection, because there's no separation. Now, when we shift our reality toward inseparability, that induces us to be compassionate and empathic and concerned about others, because the other is essentially no different than me. If I can care for the other, I'm caring for myself, because we're part of the same whole. So I apply these principles to our relationships with our thoughts, how we can overcome anxiety and depression by employing these principles, to our relationships, where we can learn to come out of arguing about objective truths, because in the quantum reality, there is no objectivity. Nothing is separate from anything else. And so I employ these principles towards helping us in our relationships, our communication, our own change process. I realized all of this through my own personal shifts by opening in this way to this new worldview. I saw the benefit to myself. I began to employ it as a therapist and in my workshops, and I saw the results. So I worked on this book for 5 years, and it was just released 2 months ago.
Congratulations.
Thank
you. Exciting. Very exciting.
Thank you. It is.
So give me an example of how this would work in either an emotional process for an individual or couples. How would we apply this?
Okay. Well, in couples work, I'm employing inseparability through my perspective as a therapist. So again, given inseparability, there is no objectivity. Objectivity is a myth based upon an old worldview of Newton's and Descartes. Now, when people say to me, you're not being objective, I say, well, that's a compliment. But there is no objectivity. I was called for jury duty a couple of years ago. I'm sitting on the witness stand being questioned as a prospective juror.
Right.
And the DA asked me, can you be impartial? I turned and I said, Judge, can I ask you a question? He said, certainly. I said, Judge, do you have beliefs? He said, well, of course I have beliefs. I said, well, so do I. A belief is a bias. It's our way of looking at something. So the answer is, no, I can't be impartial. A robot could be impartial. So we need to understand in our communications with each other to stop arguing about the truth. and to stop speaking objectively and to speak subjectively. So instead of saying to your partner, your spouse, your relative, instead of saying you are and concluding with something negative, you're all absolutely assured that they're going to dig in their heels, get reactive, we're going to go nowhere. So instead, make your statement subjective. Say, you know, when you speak that way, here's how I feel. Or I experience you as, if I speak of my feeling or my perception, I can't be told I'm wrong because feelings aren't right or wrong. Perceptions aren't right or wrong. When we speak subjectively to each other, we can begin to actually listen and ultimately to care. Because, you know, you can say, I love you, but if you love me, do you care how I feel? We can't get there when we get stuck in objective arguments. So I've written a chapter on communication in which I teach the reader how to break out of the objective. And it really opens up the possibility of real dialogue and new learning. And certainly in our culture, in our country, in this world, we're so stuck in no new learning and banging it back and forth like it's a ping pong ball. And everyone gets frustrated. No one gets anywhere. You can learn to treat it differently.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely fascinating way to look at it. And inseparability is such a powerful concept.
And you know, when we went to school, we were taught the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Nice philosophy. We don't live life that way. But given inseparability, that golden rule would make perfect sense. Because the other and I are part of the same whole. So of course I want to tend to the other. It's the opposite of what leads us toward violence and hatred.
Right. I'm also fascinated that the golden rule exists in, I think, every religion and philosophy. There is some version of it. So it's understood by philosophers and mystics in every tradition, often worded negatively. Do not do to anyone else anything you would not have done to you. It's like, pay attention. If you don't want someone to do this to you, don't do it. And some people say that's a rewording of the law of karma, but however you look at it.
True, yet in my professional experience, I would propose that an equal amount of harm is done to people through what they inflict upon themselves. You know, the most important relationship you will ever have in your life isn't with your parents, your children, your spouse. The relationship that's going to impact you more than any other relationship is with your thoughts. They're your constant companion. They can be your best ally or your worst antagonist. What I teach my reader to do is to develop the ability to see your thought and not become your thought. If you can see your thought, you're thinking. And you're not then imprisoned by the replay of old thought, which is why we struggle with change. And it's possible. It's a technique where you can learn it. It's like hearing a knock at the door. You hear the knock, you can decide to open the door or not. You hear the knock. Well, it's not difficult to learn to see your thought. And then there's a higher sense of self, a deeper, wiser, more intuitive, knowing self that can see the thought and choose to become the thought or not. That's where we enter into wisdom.
Fascinating way to look at it. I thought you were going to say our relationship with ourselves, but it really is a relationship with our thoughts. That's really...
Our relationship with ourself is essentially informed by our relationship with our thoughts.
Right.
So, some people have primary thoughts of why I can't do this, why it won't work. Mm-hmm. Some people have primary thoughts of why can't I do this? I'll go for it. That will create an entirely different life script. We have to come to understand how we came to these primary beliefs and thoughts. And I metaphorically use a phenomenon from quantum physics to explain that. Light in quantum physics, light has a dual capacity. It can exist as a wave or as a particle. And think of the wave as a state of pure potential. That's what the wave form is, pure potential. But when you observe the wave literally collapses and it becomes a particle, a fixed thing. It's called right. wave collapse. So I thought, you know, something similar happens in our lives when we're just born or early in life. Our identity isn't shaped or formed yet. We have the potential, an unlimited potential. But over time, because of things that happen, typically in childhood, and these things can be subtle or they can be traumatic, but these things happen which then inform our identity. And our state of potential becomes confined and limited. That's what I call wave collapse. For example, I was working with a woman who shared with me that when she was 9 years old, her mother told her that she wasn't a planned child. It was an accidental pregnancy. Now, at the age of nine, until I worked with her, perhaps she was 50, she felt that she was unlovable. It impacted her marriage and her friendship. She didn't feel worthy. She suffered a wave collapse, a limiting wave collapse. She wasn't special. She wasn't wanted. I helped her see how that was a constructed identity because of one sentence her mother shared with her. And from right. there, I helped her create what I call a defining moment where you can break free of the old identity. You have to be able to develop the ability to see your old thoughts and beliefs to break free. It's achievable. So you can get to remake your sense of yourself and write a new script for your life.
And so it's a fascinating way to look at it, and it does certainly fit all the principles of quantum physics.
And so going back to that state of potential,
yeah.
in the moment, in the very moment before an observation is made, quantum physics tells us everything is in a state of suspended potential. It's called superposition. Similarly, I considered in the nanosecond before I become my next thought, I too am in a state of pure potential.
Right.
But
right.
if I keep having the same old thoughts, I'm never going to access new possibilities.
Absolutely. Yeah, I get it.
That's how these quantum principles can be applied in our everyday life. So it moves us from being in a fixed state of being, stuck as a being, and it can move us into this process of becoming. Opens up the doorway all over the place. You know, and an area in my book that I dive deeply into, which might be of interest to you and your listeners, is synchronicity. The ability to move beyond the limitations of the rational mind and tune in on a universal level.
Which is very, very juicy. And let's start after the break with that. I want people to know where they can find you online so they can find out more.
My website is my name, melschwartz.com, MelschWartz.com. And you can read about my book there by clicking on the book page.
Terrific. And I'm sure the book is available on Amazon.
Available everywhere.
Okay. Just one of the wonders of our present universe that you can do that.
It certainly is.
So cool. So we're going to go to the break shortly, unless, of course, we get taller. And my guest tonight is Mel Schwartz. His book is The Possibility Principle. And I'm just finding this whole thing fascinating. So we will have much more fun when we come back. This is David Franklin Farkas, but you knew that. And this is The Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere. And this is Empower Radio. So don't go nowhere. We're going to have more fun. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Empower Radio, an entire radio station devoted to your personal development, expanding your conscious awareness, and empowering positive change. Meet our hosts and listen online at EmpowerRadio.com, on iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes, or download the Empower Radio app for your smartphone or tablet. It's free in the App Store, and it lets you listen to our shows and podcasts on demand. Empowering people, empowering change. Empower Radio, online at EmpowerRadio.com.
This is you over 30 years ago.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
And this is your mom when you drive her back from therapy.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Roles change without us noticing, and in your new role, we help you help. AARP gives you the information to help care for your mom so that you can have patience with her, just like she did with you. Visit aarp.org/caregiving or call 1-877-333-5885 to get practical health and wellness tips to provide even better care for your loved one.
Are we there yet?
Remember, visit aarp.org/caregiving. AARP, we help you help. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Today might be the day I drop out of school. Today could be the last day I try. My parents alone can't stop me. My friends can't even stop me. But you might be able to. With United Way, you could tutor me, be my mentor, or volunteer to just read with me. If someone had helped me earlier, I might not be struggling. And studies prove that kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. There are tons of ways people like you can help kids like me stay in school. And United Way is calling for you to be one of them. Because it takes 12 years to create a graduate. It takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between me becoming one or the other could be you. Make me a success, not a statistic.
Take the pledge to volunteer now at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Today, you ate Greek yogurt. You took the train. You wondered why people spend so much time reading celebrity blogs. You read a celebrity blog. You planned a workout. You skipped it. You did all the things that one normally does the day before a devastating earthquake shakes the community to the ground. You never know when the day before is the day before. Prepare for tomorrow at ready.gov/today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Be the change you want to see in the world. This is Empower Radio.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Mel Schwartz, the author of The Possibility Principle. And we were just starting on a very juicy idea. Why don't you pick up where we left off?
All right. Love to. Synchronicity. As a concept, synchronicity was created by the great psychiatrist Carl Jung. Mm-hmm. In collaboration with a quantum physicist named Wolfgang Pauli. The way Jung described it, synchronicity is what he would call a numinous event. Numinous meaning so extra special that it would make your spine tingle. And it's not simply mere coincidence. No statistical possibility would account for it occurring. And numinous means it has deep personal meaning to you. I'll give you an example. Years ago, during a holiday vacation that was at the time of the horrific tsunami in Indonesia, I was in lower Mexico on vacation with my family, and I read a report in the Times that there was no reported death of wildlife during the tsunami. The animals had a sixth sense. They knew it was coming and got to higher ground. So I went up to my hotel room to write an article. And I began to write that humans used to have this sixth sense as well, but it was driven out of our perception through our limitation or being constrained by rational thinking, being all in the mind. As I was writing these words, my window was open. A bird flew in the window and literally perched itself on the armrest of the chair I was seated on. A few seconds, which felt like an eternity. I was overwhelmed with excitement because for me, this was the physical material universe corresponding with my conscious mind, affirming what I was doing. That's synchronicity. It had personal meaning to me. The message was, universe saying to Mel, you're on the right path. Stay with this. So I sent off an email to a colleague who had just written a book on synchronicity. His name is Alan Combs, and he had written a book called Synchronicity, Myth or a Trickster. And I explained to him what happened. I was looking for his confirmation. And he wrote back and he said, that's a great example of synchronicity, Mel, but it goes further. Let me tell you what I was doing when I opened your email. He wrote to me that he was reading a book called How Animals Can Predict Earthquakes, written by the great British biologist Rupert Sheldrake.
Yep.
Well, I then wrote Sheldrake. We collaborated, and we gave a talk together at Yale on common matters and common interests. That's how synchronicity operates. This morning, on my way to my office, driving in my car, I was thinking about what's in the news all over the place, you know, the sexual harassment and sexual predatory practices of so many powerful men in the media. And I was thinking, I'm going to write an article, but the article runs deep. There's a revolution at hand now, but the consequences and implications, many of them are not considered. So I thought, what's a good title for this? And I thought to myself, there's more than meets the eye. With that, I turned on the radio to NPR, and there was a movie show on, and they said, welcome to our show, there's more than meets the eye. And once again, I thought, okay, I had this big smile on my face. I felt so excited. And I said, I am at one with the universe when this happens. My antenna is wide open. Now, I've taught synchronicity in workshops because people get excited. They say, how do you do this? Number one, you set your intention. Number two, my experience is when I began to see reality in wholeness, in oneness, this happened all the time. Here's what I mean. We tend to go around our life as though there are binoculars attached to our face. So we're seeing small pieces of reality. And we're right. Slicing and dicing and analyzing. It's like a horse with blinders on. When you operate that way, synchronicity doesn't occur. There's too much noise going on. You're blocking it out. But when you see, if you read about oneness, you can't just leave it on the theoretical level. You have to force your mind to try to see the whole. You can reduce it to see small parts when you need to, but you need to see the whole. When you open up to that and set your intention, synchronicity occurs, and it's the most meaningful, exciting experience you can have.
I have had many, many of them, some of them extremely funny. The one that comes to mind, I spent 3 years basically on walkabout. I was studying with two healers and doing all kinds of strange odd jobs to keep things together. And I don't remember what I was doing, but I was really frustrated that I wasn't getting a clear answer. And, you know, basically it was like, what? And the voice in my head said, turn on the radio in the truck. I turned on the radio and we still had Conorad. And what came through was beep, this is a test. I was like, oh, man.
Isn't that great?
Right. You know, the timing had to be absolutely exquisitely perfect for that to come out at that exact moment. There were all kinds of things like that, because that kind of training and work and being in the world that way is very much about events and going with the synchronicity and seeing what's next.
It doesn't mean we're giving up our intellect. You know, sometimes people who are not believers will say, so you're going to operate from guesswork and from hunches. No, it runs much deeper. Mm-hmm. There's a chapter in my book where I talk about what happens when we can integrate intellect and intuition and make them as one, seamless. I believe that I operate as much from a deep intuition as I do from my rational intellect, but one informs the other. They're no longer separate. And when you can blend it, and by the way, the way to know where you operate is think to yourself, do I say I think, or do you say I feel? Mm-hmm. That tells you where your orientation is. So wherever your orientation is, set the intention to turn the antenna to pick up the signal as well from the other direction. When you blend feeling and intellect, intuition and intellect, that's very powerful. It operates on warp speed faster than simple straight intelligence. But you know that, David.
Well, it's an element of, I could say it's an element of the kind of work that I do, but in order to do that work, you have to be in the world in a certain way. And that's part of that way of being in the world. So yes, I'm very familiar with it.
Right.
There are other elements. There are other stories that are incorporated into the way that I see it, which may or may not be true, but make it work. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
Where is the information coming from, or, you know, all of those kinds of things. And one of the things I've learned is it doesn't matter. It works. However, I got that little tidbit where that nudge came from. I have my way of understanding it and it works, and it doesn't really matter what, you know, is there a quote unquote concrete reality to it? What's concrete reality?
Well, you know, let's even look at the question, where is that information coming from?
Mm-hmm.
It sets up a belief that there's actually a plausible answer.
Right.
What if the answer, my belief is often, not always, but often, that it's unanswerable. You know, it's if the wind generated from the wings of a butterfly can affect distant weather patterns, it means that there's just so much that we can know for sure. And we need to let our minds release themselves from the grip of certainty, of needing to know. We have to become more comfortable but not knowing, because out of the need to know, we trick ourselves in that we know. It's a lot more fluid and wiser and conscious to allow yourself to not know for sure.
Right.
And that makes us much more open and available and vulnerable in a good way as people, if we're not so certain and sure of what we know.
Right. I have had many days where somebody has made a complete non sequitur of a statement out of nowhere that I knew mm-hmm. was very important. And my reply is always, oh, it's one of those days.
Right.
Okay. Let's see where this goes.
Exactly. It's more playful. And it's full of wonder. You know, the epidemic of depression we experience, I think, is essentially due to two things. One, that we live under the myth of separation. You know, Newton's model of reality was what he called a machine-like universe.
Right.
A great machine comprised of separate parts. So we became the separate parts in that machine. It's soulless. It has no meaning, no connectivity. In fact, it's a pretty depressing existence. No meaning, no purpose. So that sets up depression. And from that, we cling to rational, analytical thinking, and we lose a sense of wonder. It's the loss of wonder that creates depression. You show me somebody who has a good sense of wonder and imagination, they're not depressed. Show me somebody who feels connection to friends, relatives, other people, to interests, They're not depressed. Depression is a disconnect and a loss of wonder. So I think depression is a natural occurrence based upon living to an old, outmoded worldview, as is anxiety. Anxiety comes from the need to know the future. Again, Newton's determinism. If we need to know the future, we're not present. We're not in the flow of life. We're sitting back as though we're playing chess, calculating our next moves, thinking about the consequences of our actions. We should think about the consequences of our inactions, because they're due to fear, and they have a profound effect. So once again, living life under from the wrong game plan, from Newton's determinism and separation, is what causes so much of our distress and emotional and psychological illness. And it's easy to shift it when we align our new thinking with this new emerging worldview. And, you know, I find it fascinating because science, quantum physics, and spirituality and mysticism are now all in alignment with each other.
Right.
Isn't it a cool thing that science is confirming mystical traditions?
Right. And so it always cracks me up when the scientists sound more like the mystics than the mystics do.
Which happens quite often
because they're talking about things that cannot be spoken about as concrete things anymore.
Because we have to re-envision concrete is the temporary consolidation of matter, energy. Temporary. So when energy coalesces temporarily, it becomes what we call matter, right? But, you know, as you and I were speaking before the show began, let's look at the term, it doesn't matter.
Right.
You see it right there in the words, or when we're told something is immaterial. So if it's immaterial, not of matter, then it doesn't count. The language really betrays how rooted we are in a material reality rather than an energetic or spiritual reality.
Right.
That's the core of our issue, I believe.
I've always loved the expression, it's mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Which is, you know, play on words and a trick and emotionally true, but it's also literally true because you won't create it. You're not focusing on it, it won't come into reality.
And look at what happens if somebody is told they have a psychosomatic problem and
right.
they're told it's all in your mind. Well, you believe that there's a separation between your mind and body? My response
right.
is, well, so it is in my mind, and therefore it's in my body as well. What's the distinction? I don't believe there's a mind-body connection because there's no mind-body separation.
Right.
So the word connection is misleading. It's actually old thinking. Mind and body are part of the same whole. You know
right.
how we came to this concept of mind-body connection? Descartes in the 17th century said, I think, therefore I am. And with that expression, he severed philosophically mind and body. And so 400 years later, we're still buying into that myth. The head and the tail on the coin aren't separate. They're part of the same coin. My mind and my body are part of the same being. So why would it be surprising?
Right. And part of that view is cause and effect. And
yes.
I think that's where the idea of, well, it's connected. It starts here and it happens over there, which is what it looks like. My dad had two brain tumors, which were associated with traumatic events that he never resolved. And I could see exactly what had happened in both situations. And I had just been reading whoever it was at the time that was doing the literature about it. And they said 3 months after a traumatic event, it will show up as a symptomatic brain. And I was like, whoa, look at this. He did it twice. Thank you very much. You didn't have to show me that. But, you know, it was very concrete and it looks like cause and effect because there's a timeline. but the stuff was always there. It may
have been triggered. It's not visible. Right.
Right. May have been triggered by something else that brought the fear up, but it was always there. It had never gone away. And it manifested into physical reality because it was time for it to come up. It was just, I learned a tremendous amount, and it was a hard way to learn it.
A very hard way to learn it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But it's, you're giving me a lot to think about, because this whole cause and effect timeline aspect of all kinds of things, including scientific method, and looking at, in quotation marks, outcomes, once you look at it as all being connected, that timeline isn't there.
So the way to wrap your head around this differently, I found, is cause and effect. We kind of think of it in a linear way, like a straight horizontal line.
Mm-hmm.
And to the left is cause and effect. We'll take that straight linear line and turn it into a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the 12 o'clock spot and put cause there. Then at 3 o'clock, put effect. And at 6 o'clock, put cause. And at 9 o'clock, put effect. You begin to see, I wrote a poem about this once. I need to find it. Which is that this moment's cause becomes the next moment's effect. And ultimately, cause and effect blur separate
right.
distinctions. They become as one. It's just an observation being made at a moment in time. And we're going to label it cause or label it effect. See, our mind made it up. Our mind makes up things and doesn't realize it's making it up. Like, let's take in my field in psychology, diagnosis. We talk about diagnoses as though they're real things. They're not. We made them up. So
right.
if somebody says, you know, I have a client, Jane, she suffers from ADHD, I may say, what do you mean? My client Jane has ADHD. I say, how could she have something that doesn't exist? Now, it's true that people struggle with attention deficit. People struggle with hyperactive disorders. But these words are a description of what some psychiatrists thought they saw. As a description, I have no issue. But when we turn the description into a thing, it's called reification. It means our mind made something up. It forgot it made it up, and it treats it as real. That is dangerous stuff. It creates a pathology of how we see ourselves.
I have been in all the crazy stuff that's going on in the world these days, basically looking at everything and going, they just made that up and now they believe it.
Right.
And, you know, it's like for all kinds of things on all different levels, that's almost any belief system, almost any way of looking at politics or anything else. People say, this is the way it is. And then they go off and running with believing that what they said is in some way real. And they just made it up. And or they believe the stuff that somebody made up 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago without really looking at it for themselves and deciding whether it was true in this moment for in their experience. Of course, then you wind up in the world looking at all this going, just you either have to laugh or cry because it's like, really?
Well, particularly with the bizarreness of the political world today, you scratch your head. I mean, sometimes I wonder, is this man making it up? Does he know he's making it up? Does he realize he's contradicting himself? Or worse still, is he suffering from dementia and he doesn't realize what he said a moment ago was just the opposite? It's
the
bizarre.
The structure that keeps me from, you know, going off screaming into the woods with my hair on fire, of course I don't have any hair, but is that all the mystical traditions have talked about a transition from a period of darkness to a period of love and light that we don't even understand, and that there would be a transition period of great chaos. Of course, the greater the chaos, the larger the transition is going to be. And so we sit here in this transition period with all the chaos, and I look at it and go, all right, so here we are, and the change is coming, and we just have to make it through this. And that keeps me grounded in we're not going to stay here forever. And this was predicted. But yeah, it's great. What's going on is crazy, that people are piling on. The bandwagon is crazy. And then, you know, looking at the constituencies that are cheering it on, I'm like, seriously?
Yeah, these are dark times. Regrettably, only a small amount of people in this country actually vote. Regrettably.
Right.
And regrettably, so many people in our country are undereducated. And to have a conscious and thriving culture and a vibrant democracy requires an educated population. The ability to be able to discern fake news from real news. In Italy, they're now teaching college courses on and high school courses on being able to appreciate what is fake news from real news. Tragic that we've come
Brilliant.
To that. But
Brilliant.
in our country, for a number of reasons, there are tens of millions of people who can't discern what real news is.
Right.
And if you play to their fears and their hatred, and you get them out to vote, and you get other people to become apathetic and not vote, we end up where we are right now.
Right. And there are some incredibly powerful propaganda machines that are being accepted as news outlets. And it's just...
Clearly, the most powerful one of all is a propaganda outlet.
Right.
And there's a new syndicate from the right, Sinclair News, that's going to get to the right of Fox News and take them out in terms of power. the Koch brothers have funded that. So watch out for that.
Oh, dear. Well, as always happens with the most fascinating guests, we're running out of time. So,
and time is a made-up construct, but we're out of it anyway.
It certainly is, and you know we're doing this in linear time, and there's an end to the program and whatnot. But
yes.
I hope we can, in whatever ways, continue the conversation, and maybe have you on again with a more topical point of view. With it, my guest tonight is Mel Schwartz. The book is The Possibility Principle, and your website is
MelSchwartz.com.
How clever it is. So, Mel, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been great fun.
Thank you, David. My pleasure. You're welcome.
Thank you. You too. And if anybody is curious, who is this guy, David, and what in the world did he do? You can go to househealing.com. There's all kinds of technology to get in touch with me, including a scheduling link to set up a 20-minute free phone consultation to look at a person, place, situation, business, whatever it happens to be, and see how my work might be helpful to you. If you want more about the show, and we've been doing this now for 7 years. How did that happen? But that means the archive has hundreds of incredible conversations and interviews with wonderful people. So that's at thefarkasfiles.com, and you can also access it through the Empower Radio app for either flavor of smartphone and almost every streaming media outlet, iTunes podcasts, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher. We're everywhere. Or you can just search for Empower Radio or for the Farkas Files. Empower Radio has incredible shows 24/7. So you can plug in and see what appeals to you and is the kind of stuff that you're looking for right now. Wonderful, wonderful people with fascinating programs. So I hope you will take advantage of that. So here we are again. I am so grateful for all of you that listen. Otherwise, this would be a silly thing to do. So wherever you are, whenever you are, thank you one and all for being here with me. This is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere. And this is Empower Radio. Have a fantastic evening.